Python then. Bhagavatam 7 Canto, Chapter 13, to behave the perfect person. Today we'll do text 28 and probably text 29. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
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 Shrimad Bhagavatam. Ityetaratmana swatam santam visritavayakumam Pachitram asati dvaite goram apnoti sam shrutim. In this way, the conditioned soul, living within the body, forgets his self-interest because he identifies himself with the body. Because the body is material, his natural tendency is to be attracted by the varieties of the material world. Thus, the living entity suffers the miseries of material existence. Purport. Everyone is trying to be happy, as explained in the previous verse, Sukham Asyatmano Rupam Sarveho Paratistanu. When the living entity is in his original spiritual form, he is happy by nature. There is no question of miseries for the spiritual being. As Krishna is always happy, the living entities who are his parts and parcels are also happy by nature. But because of being put within this material world and forgetting their eternal relationship with Krishna, they have forgotten their real nature. Because every one of us is part of Krishna, we have a very affectionate relationship with him. But because we have forgotten our identities and are considering the body to be the self, we are afflicted by all the troubles of birth, death, old age, and disease. This misconception in materialistic life continues unless and until one comes to understand his relationship with Krishna. The happiness sought by the conditioned soul is certainly only illusion, as explained in the next verse. Om Agana Timanandasya Gananjava Shalakana Chakshur Munitadi Tasra Shikudavayamala Jai Shri Krishna Chaitanya
Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare.
Do you need the heat on? It's all right. Okay. You have enough ventilation here? Is that window going to be cold on you? Rajanai?
It's okay.
It's okay for everyone else back there? Suki, it's okay for you? Body identification is not an innocent thing. The general conception, the popular conception these days is that, yeah, okay, so what if you think you're the body? One of the natural things. Yeah, you might be spiritual, and that's cool, but what's the real danger in thinking you're the body? I mean, after all, you have it. It's yours. You can do things with it. And then you'll meet many persons who'll say, yes, we're the spirit soul, but we're also the body. So you have to indulge in the spirit soul and indulge in the body too, because we're all of them. Implicit in these misunderstandings is some false notion that it's not such a disaster to think you're the body. I mean, okay, if you want to be spirit soul, if you want to think you're spirit soul and you're going to change bodies or get out of cycle or repeat a birth and death, that's okay. But also, if you just want to be the body, you know, and go through learning experiences in this world, being the body, that's also okay. It's all basically how you feel about things. What's right for you? Everyone says this these days. You determine what's right. You understand what's right for you. So this body, I mean, it's easy to see that It's our medium of expression. So what's wrong with thinking that we're the body? This is basically what people are thinking. So therefore, because of their dense darkness of ignorance, when they hear you speak about changing bodies, getting another body, they are not afraid. That lack of fear is not based on knowledge, however, it's based on ignorance. Now, why is that happening? The Python Man is giving you insight here. In this way, the conditioned soul living within the body forgets his self-interest because he identifies himself with the body. So you can see it's not just some kind of innocuous, innocent thing to identify with the body. You choose not to, I choose to do so. So be it. There's a price you pay for identifying with the body. You forget your self-interest. You can't see it. This is what you're up against in trying to distribute Krishna consciousness, to cultivate people. You're up against persons who have forgotten their self-interest. And what caused it? Identifying with the body. Automatically blanks out your vision of who you really are and what your self-interest should be. As Prahlad Maharaj states earlier in this same seventh canto, Te vidu swapekatim hi vishnu darashraye bahir atamanina. Forgetting that the ultimate goal is Vishnu, you take shelter of the material world, which is a very difficult place to make progress. As you know, another name for the material cosmos is Durga. It's presided over by Durga Devi. Her very name lets you know what's going on. In Sanskrit, Ga means progress, Dur means difficult. It's going to be very, very difficult to make any progress within this fortress of material existence. But influenced by the bodily conception of life, you take shelter of material existence. And you consider the external, the superfluous, to be having real value. Artamanina. You think, this is the important thing. This is the value. This is for my heart. This will fulfill me. Dharashaye artamanina. And then, what's the result of that? You can't even see the result. You notice people don't even care about the result. Anda yatanda upagiyamana. You become... You get on board the train, so to speak, taking you down to a vulnerable situation to your next life. Being tightly tied up by the ropes of material nature. Well, this is what you're up against. People who can't see who they are, they can't see their self-interest. It's all forgotten by them. It's like you're trying to wake someone up from sleep, and that person has no remembrance of what it's like to be awake. So they just say, leave me, let me sleep, let me sleep. I'm in the real world, I'm in the dream world. No, there's a world of the awake. What are you talking about? That's what you think. If that's right for you, then be awake. But for me, the real thing is to be asleep. So, another way of looking at it is, actually, I've seen this. Someone can be sick for so long that they forget what it's like to be healthy. You've seen that? They actually just forget what it's like to be healthy, and sometimes they even lose the urge to become healthy again. I've tried so many doctors. I've been sick for so long. What's the use? This is just the way life is. It's only if and when they become healthy again, do they realize, wow, there is such a thing as healthy life. Forgetfulness is an inherent part of material existence. We should understand that principle. Where does the forgetfulness come from? By identifying with your body. you automatically sign the dotted line forgetfulness. It's part of the contract. People just think, I identify with the body, big deal. You don't? Okay, good on you. I do. Just get on with life. But no. By identifying with the body, you sign up for so many things. Forgetfulness. Then what else? Because the body is material, his natural tendency is to be attracted by the varieties of the material world. So not only do you identify with the body and all of its cycles, but you also identify with the material world, which is impinging or affecting your body. So you take it all on board, all that baggage. Not just body identification, but also identification with the external material world. Because the body doesn't exist in a vacuum. It doesn't exist in isolation. The body is part of material nature. It's immersed in the web of actions and reactions of material nature. And you're identifying with all that. It's not that you're just identifying with your body. No, you get the whole shebang. While you're forgetting your actual identity and your actual purpose in life, your actual self-interest. This is the great power of the illusory energy. This is how tragic forgetfulness is. Try to see the complete picture. Body identification means identification with material existence and all of its actions and reactions and permutations. In this way, how can you have any peace? With all that, how can you have any peace? Impossible. The Python Man is giving us very crucial knowledge here. He's pointing out, this is the process that results in the living entity suffering the miseries of material existence. You shouldn't have to, but you do. And your problems all begin with identification with the body. Now, in the purport, you see that we freely admit that everyone's trying to be happy. We don't see anything wrong with that. Sometimes people misperceive that all you Krishna conscious people are against happiness, you're against love. No, we firmly recognize the basic principle that everyone is trying to be happy. We know why you're trying to be happy. You're trying to be happy because that's the nature of your original spiritual form. You're happy by nature. Ananda Mayobhyasa, Vedanta Sutra says, the living entities, they're by nature happy. But you've made a mistake. You're out of your element. You're a fish out of water, so to speak. And therefore, all the miseries come upon you. We don't object to people trying to be happy or wanting to be happy. We recognize that as the eternal nature of their true self, the spirit self. But they're trying to be happy in the wrong way, in the wrong place. That is the problem. They've forgotten their real self-interest. As soon as you identify with the body, the forgetfulness must be there. And then you take on the bondage of a body and the material world. You're bound tightly to the body and to the material world. By the arrangement of Maya, you feel at home in your body and at home in material existence. You ever catch yourself feeling that way? Yeah, this feels kind of natural. Here I am in my home. Here I am in my hometown. Here I am in the city of my birth, the land of my birth. That's why it's generally very good for those in the renounced order to not stay in the place of their birth. And sometimes it happens for sake of preaching, but if you look at our leaders in Krishna consciousness, most of them have gone to their place of birth, the city of their birth, because there's a natural feeling you get of just being in your city of birth. You know, you're just habituated in a certain way to the modes there, whether consciously or unconsciously. You identify. people who travel, they always say, like New Zealanders, when they go for their OE, their overseas experience, they say, oh, I want to feel different cultures. I want to feel how different people act. I want to get out of this little world of New Zealand and open myself up. The idea is that they want to get out of their conditioning. But of course, because all their activities are on the material plane, they just change varieties of conditioning when they travel, that's all. Real traveling means to journey away from the bodily conception of life and identifying with the material world and arriving at your original spiritual nature. That is real traveling. So you can tell that to the backpackers. They're not only carrying on their back their pack, but they're carrying all their conditioning from one country to another. So please remember, we have nothing against people wanting to be happy. Indeed, we're all for it. We recognize it as the eternal nature of the original self. But they're looking for happiness in the wrong way, in the wrong place. We're instructed here that as Krishna is always happy, the living entities who are parts and parcels are also happy by nature. Now we have no problem, those of us who know about Krishna, understanding that Krishna is always happy. But we are supposed to be happy by nature because we're part of Krishna. What happened? What happened is exactly what's described by the Python man in this verse. You forgot your self-interest because you identified with the body. Because every one of us is part of Krishna, we have a very affectionate relationship with him. But because we have forgotten our identities and are considering the body to be the self, we are afflicted by all the troubles of birth, death, old age, and disease. This misconception in materialistic life continues unless and until one comes to understand his relationship with Krishna. There you have it. Now what are you going to do about it? Just as Krishna is always happy, we should always be happy. When you read Krishna's pastimes, you see, Krishna's always happy. Sometimes, if you're contaminated, you'll get envious. Why is Krishna always happy? That can't be God. If I'm suffering, and there's a God who's always happy, that's the first proof that religion is bogus. Sounds brilliant. Yes. How can there be a God when I'm suffering? Makes sense. That all adds up. Some of the most so-called brilliant scientists in the world, this is what they say. I told you, after the tsunami, they were saying like that. Just see what kind of God would allow 200,000 people to be wiped out by a wave. Think about it. It all adds up. It all adds up in a demoniac, twisted mind, forgetful of real self-interest and what is reality. I've told you before, in my pre-devotional days, how one companion of mine, I gave the person a Krishna book, seeking to enliven the person in Krishna consciousness. So I'll never forget. The person, the companion, took the Krishna book, opened it to the first page, beginning pages, where it said, Krishna the Supreme Enjoyer. Krishna the Supreme Enjoyer. How dare there be a Supreme Enjoyer? What kind of knowledge is this? This is corrupt, perverted. How can there be a Supreme Enjoyer other than us? If we're not enjoying supremely, then there's no supreme enjoyer. If we're not happy by our efforts, then it's not possible for anyone to be supremely happy. There's envy and frustration. If I can't get it, no one gets it. You ever dealt with someone like that? They're angry. They couldn't get something, and they didn't want anyone else to get it. I've seen it, especially in families where the single mother with children and the mother is getting old and doesn't have any partner, husband, boyfriend, whatever you want to call these days. And so often she tries to restrict her daughters in their attempts to enjoy. But basically, unconsciously, she's thinking, since I have to be miserable, you should be miserable too. You ever seen that? It's getting, as things get more and more wild and the family breaks down, these things are fading out. New perversions appear. It's like the whole world is horrified now because of what happened in France. You've heard, Benedict? This ideal town in France called Angers. You heard of that town? Oh, that's how you pronounce it. How do you pronounce it?
Angers.
Ideal city, yes? Picturesque and all that? Mm-hmm. Yes. It turned out that they just arrested 40 persons. Parents who were selling their children to pedophiles. Parents. Mm-hmm. Who would sit smoking in one room with other parents, chatting away, while their kids were being assaulted in the other room, and the parents would collect money. Parents doing that with their own children. Horrible. What's going on? This is what happens when you saturate the television, the movies, the books with lust. People go crazy. That's what Bhagavad Gita says. You lose all intelligence, you go crazy. This is what happens when you leave people to think each one should decide what's right. I guess in their demented way, the parents are thinking, since all there is lust, we're lusty, the kids are going to be lusty, might as well make some money out of it. This is all that's going on in the world anyway. Okay, if we can supplement our income, why not? Our kids are going to be doing this anyway, trashing themselves out. We've trashed ourselves out, all there is trash, so let's make some money out of the trash. But yes, parents were doing this with their own children. Their children, their nieces, their nephews. It was a whole cartel, so they arrested about 40 people. They had high-class people with suits and ties come flying in, covering their faces. They had a mask on their face wearing business suits and ties, and they would pay their money and do these degraded activities with the children. It wasn't just low-class people. No, once the word got out amongst the perverts, that high-class perverts from all over France were flying in. So you're thinking, how could such a thing happen? As Krishna explains in Bhagavad Gita, by meditating on the objects of the senses, lust develops. And comes attachment, anger, bewilderment, loss of intelligence, deep into the material pool of ego. Shocking. Everyone's just outraged in France. Such an ideal, picturesque town. The town did everything. Or it's a city, yes? The city did everything right. It sprinkled its poor people, its low-class people, amongst the rich people, because they didn't want a low-class section, so they had the low-class people living amidst the so-called high-class people. Everything was done so nicely, according to the latest town planning ideas and conceptions. And then look what goes on. How old were the kids? Starting with 5 years old. Between 5 and 13 was the oldest. It wasn't just men. It was also ladies. Ladies attacking children. Male children. So, this is the situation these days. So we were speaking about how I've seen in the past when ladies are starting to become spinsters or feel they're becoming spinsters. They get very resentful, even of their own daughters, that their daughters are enjoying. So they try to curtail it in some way. That is the way envy is. I can't enjoy, you can't enjoy. We do this to Krishna. We're having a problem enjoying, so there's no such thing as Krishna's enjoyment. You don't even want to hear about it. That's the symptom of conditioned soul. I don't want to hear about Krishna. You know that feeling? I don't want to hear about it. Everybody does that from time to time.
Yes, who devotees
have that? I don't want to hear about it. So that's what we unconsciously say when it comes to Krishna. I don't want to hear about him. Prabhu, just hear and chant the glories of the Lord. Be practical. That's a nice way of saying I don't want to hear about it. Be practical. Krishna is always happy. And we're happy to hear about Krishna's happiness. That is our joy. Let's talk about Vrindavan Dham. We're going to go to the summer leelas in Vrindavan to see how Krishna is always happy with his associates. We're going to go to the leela that happened, at least it's presented in Bhagavatam, right after the killing of Janukasura and his mates. That killing of Janukasura and his mates, that's a Kartik pastime, around the Gopashtami time. This pastime we're going to talk about is around the time in summer when the heat is very hot. Some of you have attempted to be in Vrindavan during the summer. Nothing like it, though. Can't believe things get that hot, though. So, after Krishna and Balaram killed the ass demons, the demigods showered flowers, offering music and prayers and glorification. The astonishment was how easily and casually Krishna and Balaram killed these ass demons. Krishna doesn't have to do anything. Doesn't have to act to kill these demons, but he does act to give pleasure to his devotees and to enjoy the sport for himself. He has no desire, but why not? It'll enliven the devotees. It's interesting, killing demons by grabbing their hind legs and whirling them around, throwing them in trees. Balaram, let's do it. That is God, self-sufficient. Well, the demigods were astonished by such ease and casualness in the slaying of all these demons. So they showered flowers, playing music. By Krishna's killing the demons, Krishna and Balaram's killing the demons, they actually created freedom. This is how Krishna consciousness creates freedom. The people felt free to return to the Talavan forest. And they felt they could eat the fruits now without fear. And then the cows could freely graze on the grass. This is the practical effect of Krishna consciousness. Practical freedom. We can go to the forest now. We can eat the fruits now. The cows can eat the grass now. Practical example about how Krishna consciousness affects everything. Freedom through Krishna consciousness. If your freedom doesn't come through bhakti, it's not coming at all. You can say free this, free that. Free speech, free sex, free drugs, free marijuana, free. You'll not have any freedom, though. Freedom only comes through bhakti. This is a very deep point you should have to think about. Because material nature is constantly making propositions to you that you should surrender to material nature and be free. That's why in the second chapter of the Gita, Krishna talks about the regulated principles of freedom. Through following spiritual discipline, you actually become free. But material nature is always trying to affect your mind. Just let your senses go wild. Haven't you had enough of trying to adhere to this bhakti lifestyle? don't just want to sleep all the time and eat whatever you want and just let your senses go whatever way they want. Just relax. That's what material nature proposes to you. You're not allowed to see the reality, which is you would settle for enslavement. You would choose enslavement by pursuing that so-called freedom. Freedom comes through purification, through loving Krishna. That's the ultimate act of purification, loving Krishna. Therefore, Vrindavan is always completely pure because everyone is 100% in love with Krishna. Now, it's time for Lord Krishna to return from the forest to the village. What's happening while Krishna's been gone in the forest? The young gopi girls are in complete anxiety. Oh, we can't live without Krishna. When will Krishna return? We know what's going on in the forest. His soft lotus feet are being pricked by little pebbles. Those feet are so soft. They're so soft, even for them to touch our bodies, those feet are too soft. Yet those same lotus feet are walking in the forest over little stones and pebbles. They're identifying in that way with Krishna's pleasure. What are Krishna's feet experiencing? They're feeling intense separation during the day. Do you ever remember what that feels like? Someone goes away just for the day and you feel intense separation. When is that person returning? Maybe when you were a teenager and you had your first so-called romantic affair. Oh, I can't wait to go to school tomorrow to see that person again. All these spiritual things are reflected in the material world, and that reflection is so troublesome. But the thing of itself, in of itself in the spiritual world, is simply pure bliss. So the gopis' feelings of separation, that anguish is pure bliss. This cannot be understood with material senses. Now Krishna is on his way back. Sukadeva Goswami describes Krishna as Kamala Pratraksha, Lotus-Eyed Lord. That same name, Kamala Pratraksha, is also there, 11th chapter of Bhagavad Gita. His eyes are like lotus petals. If you've ever seen a lotus petal, then you would understand how the Lord gets this nomenclature. And Sukadeva Goswami says the Lord is Punya Shravana Kirtana. That's also there in the first canto of Bhagavatam. Hearing about Krishna, chanting about Krishna, is the most pious activity. It's the most religious activity. That's another way of saying that Shravana Kirtana is beyond any material benefit. By saying it's the most pious activity, just a way of emphasizing that it's beyond piety. Krishna is returning to Vrindavan. Balaram is there. The cowherd boys are there. As he's marching out of the forest, the cowherd boys are chanting his glories. So just visualize this party leaving the forest to come back to Vrindavan. Now, let's visualize Krishna. How does he look coming out of the forest back into the town of Vrindavan? Think about his hair powdered with the dust from the cows. Also in his hair is the peacock feather and forest flowers. We want to meditate on Krishna's return from the forest. We've been waiting to see him all day. Now he's returning. The dust in his hair from the cow's hooves is beautifying. The peacock feather is there. The forest flowers are there. And what is the Lord doing? He's playing his flute and he's glancing here and there. His glance is very charming and his smile is so beautiful. Think about that. What's the reception like as he walks into town with his cowherd boys. The gopis immediately come out of their houses. They are so eager to see him. Their eyes are eager. Try to feel what that's like, to have eager eyes. The eagerness that's in the heart gets packed up into the eyes, and the eyes become eager. Try to feel eager eyes. This way, when we read Krishna's pastimes, we should get into it. Eager eyes. Yes, these things are not there in the material world, except slightly. But if you start to think about them as presented by the Shastra, you'll start to revive your original spiritual sentiments. The Shastra says eager eyes. Is it like that, eager eyes? Your soul knows, your true identity knows, but you've forgotten to get contact with the body, identifying with the body. As Krishna walks into the town, the gopis have come out of their houses, and they're doing three things. Glancing at Krishna with their eager eyes, relishing the sweet sound of his flute, and savoring the enchanting fragrance of his body. Complete sensory experience is there in Krishna consciousness. We're so crazy, we think the material world is so necessary with its crude and perverted sense objects. But now you're hearing about the real food for the senses. For your ears, it's Krishna's flute. For your nose, it's the smell of Krishna's body. And for your eyes, it's the form of the beautiful Lord. So this is the gopis' world. Fully 100% Krishna. What are they staring at? Mukunda Mukha, the lotus-like face of Lord Mukunda. That's there. That's the focus of their eyes. And what kind of eyes do they have? Before you heard that their eyes were eager. Now, meditate on this concept of Aksha Bringa. Their eyes are bee-like. You ever seen bees buzzing around a flower? So the gopis' eyes are like bees that just... they're just buzzing around Krishna's face. Very beautifully poetic and spiritually appropriate. With their eyes, they're drinking the honey of Krishna's beautiful face. And in this way, they give up all the feelings of separation they had during the day. This viraha bhava, loving ecstasies and separation, is the most confidential part of Krishna knowledge. How the pleasure is actually more in separation than in meeting. Now, let's get into the whole scene in terms of the ecstatic details. These young ladies of Vrindavan, the Braja Naris, what are they doing? You know that they're looking at Krishna, but they just don't look at Krishna. There's an art, there's a culture for everything. Just because there's no culture anymore in the material world doesn't mean that the spiritual world lacks culture. No, they just don't look. They do it with such perfect finesse and bhakti perfection. They're casting sidelong glances at Krishna. Why? Because they're chaste. They look out of the corner of their eyes. They don't stare directly at Krishna because they're chaste young girls. I guess young girls don't do this anymore. Sidelong glances. It's all just... One couple there now, nice devotees. They told me in their mundane days when they were first meeting each other. Yeah, the teenage girl said to the young man, in order to get the relationship going, "You're not talking to me enough." Let's get the relationship on, you know. "You're not talking to me enough." In other words, you know, let's start something. That's the way it is these days, you know. There's just no compunction, you know. So, but chaste ladies, they know how to do that. They know how to look out of the side of their eyes bashfully. I was explaining to one devotee yesterday how the Bhagavatam says that chaste women develop mystic power just by being chaste. These things are unknown today. They don't even know what the word chaste means. I had this experiment once at the loft in a workshop. There was like a room full of teenage girls that come for some reason. So I asked them, does anyone know what the word chaste means? They start going, it's somewhere in the far past, but no, none of them knew what it meant. Chaste. Well, this is what's going on. Because of ignorance, we accept this passionate Rajagun, Tamagun culture. It's actually no culture, but just animal life, as liberating, as invigorating. But when you hear Krishna Leela, when you get into the details of the reciprocation, you see what is real artistry, what is real culture, what is real reciprocation, and your consciousness is just captured. Everything is exquisite. Everything is so satisfying for the soul. So as the gopis are looking at Krishna out of the sides of their eyes, those glances that they're giving are filled with three things: bashfulness, laughter, and submission. It's all packed into the glance, the sidelong glance. Bashfulness, laughter, and submission. All that into a sidelong glance. That's power. The power is so great it controls even Krishna. So, what does Krishna do? He completely accepts their glances, their sidelong glances packed with bashfulness, laughter, and submission. He accepts them as the most respectful offering. You see, in Vrindavan, there's no awe and reverence. We explained before how in our temples we worship Radha Krishna in the mood of Lakshmi Narayan. Awe and reverence, opulence, strict rules. But in Vrindavan, there's none of that. So Krishna accepts the sidelong glances of the gopi girls as the most respectful, suitable offering. He accepts that with his heart. He takes their offering into the temple of his heart. Very important. Now, the acharyas give wonderful details of what's going on in this glancing. As the gopis, they're leaving home. They're rushing out of home into the street to see Krishna coming. They tell their husbands, "Are you going to stop us or kill us?" Just go out. Of course, the husbands, they're devotees of Krishna too. Everyone is a devotee of Krishna. But Yogamaya has been acting in this way just to create the excitement and the pastime. Everyone in Vrindavan sacrifices everything for Krishna. There's no other thought. But just to add excitement to the pastime, the young gopi girls, as they're rushing out of their house, they just tell their husband, "Are you going to stop us or kill us?" They go out anyway. How can you resist Krishna? Krishna is the actual husband. So, they look at Krishna with sidelong glances. And then, while Krishna's not looking, they start staring with wide open eyes. They don't do it when Krishna's watching, but when he's not looking. Then, Krishna, they see he's paying attention to them. They see he's seeing them now. So then, their smile of jubilation takes over. But they're bashful, they're chaste. So the next thing they do is, because Krishna's looking at them now, they don't want Krishna to see that, at least at this point, that they're just staring at him. So they cover their smiling mouths with their left hand, they pull the top of their sari down over their eyes. Which is also intoxicating and enchanting. Everything in Vrindavan is so intoxicating and enchanting. So they do like that. Then Krishna, with his glance, starts to plunder. Krishna's glance pushes back their bashfulness. It acknowledges it at first, the acharyas say, but then Krishna's glance, like it just, forget all this bashfulness, it just pushes it aside. The gopis, with their smile and with their glances, are actually making offerings, as we said before. Their eyes are like hands that are offering the flower of the glance, their glance to the Lord. And their lips are like hands that are offering the flower of smiling to the Lord. You can see that their eyes have hands that are offering the flower-like glance to the Lord. And their lips are like hands that are offering a smile to the Lord. This is how captivating Vrindavan is. You can just go on and on just thinking about these things. And Krishna accepts these offerings by the hands of their eyes and the hands of their lips. He accepts them deep into the temple of his heart. So then, Krishna and Balaram, they go to their home. And Mother Yashoda and Mother Rohini, they're obviously showing them the greatest affection, affection that cannot be conceived of in the material world. They offer the best of everything to Krishna and Balaram. The Shastra says, Yatha Kalam means whatever the boys want, according to their desire. But Yatha Kalam means according to regulation, rule and regulation. In other words, Rohini and Yashoda were not the kind of parents who just say, whatever makes you happy, we'll give you. No, they fulfilled the desires of their children according to proper rules and regulations. That meant, although they were always giving Krishna and Balaram beautiful clothes, jewelry, food, toys, and constant affection, still they made sure their boys ate and slept on time. That's the meaning of yatha kalam. Not just yatha kalam, whatever they want. It's modern parenting. Whatever makes you happy, just do it. As is common in New Zealand. If it makes you happy, you're 14 years old, you got a boyfriend, bring him home, have him live with you. Yatha kalam. Whatever makes you happy. No, yatha kalam. Whatever Krishna Balaram wanted for happiness, according to the rules and regulations that the parents knew were necessary for raising healthy children. Sometimes Rohini, Yashoda Mai, they would pick up Krishna Balaram, embrace them, and then check their limbs to see if they were healthy, growing up properly. So they were very affectionate mothers, more affectionate than anyone could conceive of in the material world. Yet, they adhered to the principles of proper parenting. Because that's part of love. Then they would bathe and massage the two lords. You see where a lot of our deity worship procedures come from. They bathe and massage the two lords because Krishna is apparently feeling weary from walking on so many country roads as he's taking care of the cows in the forest. There's no weariness actually for the Lord, but this is his pastime. Experiencing the fun of being tired. Oh, we're tired. Now our mothers have bathed us and massaged us. Oh, this is so nice. After they're bathed and massaged, they're dressed in beautiful clothes, decorated with garlands and fragrances. This is the home life of Krishna and Balaram. This is Mother Yashoda and Mother Rohini. Showing their praying, their affection. Hearing these pastimes fills us with happiness. And we can see how easy it is to be happy just by hearing about Krishna. This is what a devotee wants. let me just come to the point of understanding that simply by hearing about Krishna, I'm happy. I don't need all these complications that the material world offers. So after bathing and massage, what's it time for? Who knows? No, prasad! Yes! Sumptuous prasad given by their two mothers. And then they're pampered in various ways. What are some of the ways they're pampered? The two boys. The mothers sing of their glories as the boys lay on a beautiful sheet, beautiful bed to go to sleep. The mothers sing of their pastimes. And then Krishna and Balaram go to sleep. Your heart becomes relieved of all anxiety and false perception of happiness just by hearing about the happiness of Krishna, the residents of Vrindavan. Your concocted pursuit of pleasure is extinguished. What does Krishna say in the second chapter of the Gita? When you give up the concoction of material pleasure seeking, then you can be peaceful. Then you're properly situated in yoga when you've abandoned all concoctions about material pleasure. Catch your mind concocting. Did we speak about this before? You can watch your mind, see how it concocts, how you're going to be happy in this way, you're going to be happy in that way, this is going to be good for you. All day long, the mind's concocting. There'll only be peace when you abandon those concoctions. You have to be able to look your mind in the face and say, you're lying. You're cheating. Then your mind starts to become submissive. Because what does that mean? It means your intelligence has disciplined your mind. With your intelligence, you tell that wild mind, you don't know what you're talking about. You're cheating. You're lying. It's a very strong, isn't it, the mind? Ooh, it's going to be like this. Ooh, it's going to be like that. Ooh, enthralling, absorbing, intoxicating, bewildering in a nice way. With your intelligence, which is strengthened by the Shastra, you say to the mind, you're lying, you're cheating, it's not like that. That shows that the intelligence, the next door neighbors of the soul, is taking control of your life. So we want our devotees to be armed with intelligence. We don't want them to be on the mental platform. Therefore, Krishna says, when you give up all varieties of sense gratification, which stem from mental concoction, then you can be properly situated in yoga. You cannot control your senses by force. Success is only there by absorbing your senses in devotional service and experiencing yourself as Krishna's eternal servant. That's the only successful method for controlling your senses. Alright, Krishna and Balaram, they've gone to sleep. And then Shukadeva Goswami tells us how the two lords are wandering around in Vrindavan. This time Krishna is without Balaram because it's Balaram's birthday. As I said, these are summer pastimes. Balaram's birthday is a couple of weeks before Janmashtami, Krishna's birthday. So Balaram's at home getting his birthday rituals. So Krishna and the cowherd boys, they go to the Jamuna River. And apparently the cowherd boys and the cows are feeling acute distress from the heat in Vrindavan, the summer sun. Now you say, how can there be this suffering? They're Krishna's associates in Vrindavan. It's not material suffering. It's the bliss of suffering. It's 100% Krishna conscious. It's just another kind of bliss. Oh, it's so hot! Oh. They don't have material bodies, though. You can't understand this on a material platform. Suffering is suffering! It's miserable! How can someone enjoy it? Oh, it's so hot! Oh. All the varieties in Vrindavan are simply blissful. Whether it's cool, warm, hot, cold, whatever. just a different way of enjoying Krishna consciousness. Oh, it's hot. So Krishna was walking behind, and the cows and cowher boys, they had gone ahead because they were so thirsty because of the heat, they just ran to the Jamuna River, and Krishna was lagging behind. And they began to drink the water of the Jamuna River. But that water had been afflicted by, contaminated with poison, because Kaliya is around. Now, this is an interesting point. By the mystic potency, the daiva of the Supreme Lord, the boys lost consciousness, apparently died. As soon as they touched the poison water, by the divine power of the Lord, they lost consciousness. They fell lifeless at the water's edge. And then Krishna, who's known as Yogeshvareshwara, the master of the master of the master of the masters of mystic power, he brought them back to life just by his glance. And what is the nature of that glance of the Lord that brought the cowher boys back to life? Brought the cows back to life? Nectarian glance. So what did the cowherd boys say as soon as they came back to consciousness? They began to look at one another in astonishment. Do you know what just happened? We just died. And we came back to life. How did it happen? Was it by some mantra that we came back to life? Was it by some herbs? And another cowherd boy said, no, I think Krishna did it. I think Krishna brought us back to life. Really? He said, do you remember? I remember when we were little boys. Garga Muni, the great sage, at Krishna's and Balaram's name-giving ceremony, he spoke about Krishna, saying he was a special child. Oh, that could be it. So he brought us back to life. Wow. Then what was the cowherd boy's conclusion? It's possible that our little friend Krishna has done this because, according to the sage Garga Muni, our friend Krishna has been empowered by Narayan, who's worshipped by Nanda Maharaj. Nanda Maharaj worships Narayan, therefore Narayan empowered Krishna. Yes. Therefore he brought us back to life. He had that ability. Now why did Krishna do this? It's pastime, Leela. Why did, by his daiva, he arrange that his cowherd boys and cows would lose consciousness and give up their life, so to speak? They're eternal, but Krishna wanted them to experience, you know, dying and then being rescued by Krishna. Even though they're eternal. Only Krishna's energies can do that. They're not in material bodies. How can they die? There's no death for them. But Krishna wanted to increase their relationship. Okay. After they drink the poison water, they'll apparently die and come back to life. Let them have that fun. Let them enjoy that way. This is Vrindavan. Even so-called dying is blissful. They're eternal. There's no actual death. And when the cowherd boys come to, they're astonished. Wow, we died. Wow, we died. And Krishna brought us back to life. Wow. It's the nature of Krishna's pastimes. Simply by the nectarian glance of Krishna, they were revived, apparently. Although everyone in Vrindavan is eternally revived. So, this is our natural happiness. We're looking for this happiness in the material world. That is our big mistake. We're looking for the nectar of these kind of relationships within the material world. That nectar can be found in relationships in the material world when devotees together glorify Krishna and together serve Krishna. Then you get a taste of that eternal nectar. Because when devotees come together to glorify Krishna and serve Krishna, Krishna is completely in the center. The more that Krishna is in the center of relationships, the more you taste the spiritual world. If you understand that principle, you'll be saved from the foolish endeavor to try to taste happiness from material relationships. As devotees, yes, we have relationships. As devotees, we need relationships. But with Krishna in the center, we don't want to lose our relationships. When Krishna is in the center of any kind of relationship, then we can taste this original nectar of the spiritual world that we hear about in Krishna Lila. So what do you do with devotees? You hear about Krishna with devotees. You chant about Krishna with devotees. You serve Krishna together with devotees. You make plans to serve Krishna with devotees. That's what you do. And then Krishna is in the center. So please remember these penetrating points by the Python Man. The conditioned soul living within the body forgets his self-interest because he identifies himself with the body. Because the body is material, his natural tendency is to be attracted by the varieties of the material world. Thus, the living entity suffers the miseries of material existence. So there's nothing innocent about identifying with the body. When you do so, you get hit with two things: forgetfulness, and then not simply are you identifying with the body, but you also get identification with the whole material surroundings along with it. You take on all that, and then you suffer, forgetting your real self-interest, forgetting your natural happiness with Krishna. All right.